This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, as U.S. intelligence agencies expand spying operations against Russia on a greater scale than at any time since the end of the Cold War, what is the status of U.S.-Russian relations? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. After a series of cyber attacks attributed to hackers linked to Russian intelligence, most recently on the Democratic National Committee and on WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, not to mention the invasion and then annexation of Crimea in March 2014, destabilizing activities in eastern Ukraine, Moscow's intervention in Syria in September 2015, which rescued the tottering regime of Bashar al-Assad, can Washington trust Vladimir Putin's Russia? Back in 2009, the Obama administration tested whether it could have a more collaborative relationship with Russia under then-President Dmitry Medvedev. It was an attempt to, quote, reset the more adversarial relationship, which had evolved under the second George W. Bush administration. But when current President Vladimir Putin, previous prime minister and previous two-term president, announced his intention to run again for president in 2012, Russia saw some of the biggest protests in Moscow since the 1990s. Putin later blamed Washington for inciting the protests, stoked anti-American sentiment, and began to curtail the operation of foreign-controlled NGOs perceived as providing assistance to liberal opposition groups. The hacking of the DNC has led to allegations that Russia is meddling in the U.S. presidential election on the side of Republican Donald Trump. All this has led to efforts to rebuild U.S. intelligence capabilities that had atrophied after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Well, with us to analyze the current state of U.S.-Russian relations are two distinguished analysts. William Pomerantz is Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington. He's also professor for the Center of Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies at Georgetown University. And Jeffrey Mankoff, he's Deputy Director and Senior Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasian Program. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Glad Thanks. To be here.
Well, Will Pomerantz from the Wilson Center, let me begin with you. How would you characterize the current state of U.S.-Russian relations, given all that we just talked about?
Well, I think they're very much at a low ebb, to put it mildly. Clearly, there's lots of areas of tension that you just described in Syria, in Ukraine, over Crimea. We still have a very severe sanctions regime against Russia as a result of what happened in eastern Ukraine and Crimea. And there's also been all the other sources of tension, including doping and hacking and all the rest. What's interesting is that even under these conditions, at least in certain circumstances, the Obama administration has tried to find areas, not necessarily of agreement, of at least areas that they can begin to discuss and address. And we've seen this, obviously, with the most recent ceasefire negotiations in Syria. But I think even as those negotiations were ongoing and as they've been reported, I still think there is a very high level of mistrust. Indeed, Obama has said, going into these negotiations over Syria with Russia, that he did not trust the Russians. Nevertheless, I think from their perspective on what's available, from a humanitarian perspective, they felt that something had to be tried, even though they don't trust the Russians. And thus, we're now already watching the attempts to implement this agreement and already the charges that it's not being fully enforced.
Well, let me turn now to Jeffrey Mankoff for your take on U.S.-Russian relations to date.
Yeah, obviously they're pretty bad, but I think that there's a difference between the disputes that we're having with the Russians now and the whole history of disputes that we've had with them going back since the end of the Cold War. Because up until, let's say, 2011, 2012, there were plenty of things that we disagreed with the Russians about. We had spy scandals, we had tensions over Georgia, we had tensions over NATO expansion. We had a whole list of things where we found ourselves on opposite sides. But there was never an operating assumption here that the Russians saw themselves as a strategic rival, that they saw their interests as being advanced by trying to prevent us from doing the things that we sought to do, or that they were trying to overturn the basic pillars of the post-Cold War international security order. And I think now there's been a reassessment of the role that Russia is playing, largely for, I think, domestic political reasons within Russia itself. Moscow now is not only disagreeing about a whole set of concrete issues like the ones that Will listed, but also is portraying itself on a global level as being a rival to the United States, that in most cases its interests are best served by blocking or trying to undermine U.S. interests in a very kind of Cold War dynamic, and at the same time that Russia's trying to make fundamental changes to the rules of the game that emerged, at least in Europe, at the end of the Cold War. And so this is a much deeper period of tension between the U.S. and Russia than any that's existed since 1991.
Turning back to you, Will Pomerantz, was really struck by what Jeffrey just said and reminding us that, in fact, Vladimir Putin is attempting to overturn the pillars of the post-Cold War political order. One could even argue post-World War II, given the invasion and annexation of Crimea, which was part of Ukraine, now Russia. I mean, that plus the litany of other things we talked about. How is it that the United States either missed this, underestimated, you know, this challenge?
I think what the United States underestimated was the extent of the rebuilding of the Russian military that occurred in many ways over the last 8 years. The assumption was that Russia was still the Russia of the late Soviet period and early post-Soviet period, where they really weren't in a position to mount any sort of direct challenge militarily, economically, ideologically to the United States. And the assumption was that really that hadn't changed. And I think what the U.S. did not anticipate was not only Putin's decision in 2007 really to seek an alternative foreign policy, that he was no longer going to cooperate, but that Russia was actually going to make an investment, a significant investment, to strengthen their military and to use that military when it saw options to use it. I don't think Russia anticipated that it was going to equal the American military or directly challenge it as a global superpower. But nevertheless, Russia decided to invest and to assert its interests where it saw the opportunity. And I think that's what we underestimated, the extent that by which, as Jeff mentioned, that Russia decided that it wasn't going to play by the post-World War II rules, that Russia was going to do what Russia has always done and seek its own foreign policy advantages on its own terms. And if that meant going against the standard or perceived global rules that had been set by the United States and Western Europe in the aftermath of World War II, then it was going to do so. I think the other thing that we did not anticipate is that Russia would pursue that foreign policy even if it went against its economic interest. We assumed that Russia was going to want to integrate in global institutions and find its own role in the global economy. That's what essentially we promised Russia at the end of the Cold War. And I think we did not anticipate that Russia would be willing to pursue its foreign policy objectives, even if they directly undermined its economic interests. But that's what it decided to do.
So, Jeffrey Mankoff, what are the factors in your view that led either the United States to miss this or underestimate the intentions of Vladimir Putin in particular?
I do think there was, as Will said, an unwillingness to recognize that Russia was willing to act in ways that were counter to its own economic interests. I think the other thing that happened was the United States stopped focusing on Russia as a threat because of the perception here that the Cold War was over, that we had won, that the Russians had recognized that a confrontation with the U.S. was not something that was sustainable and that wasn't going to be good for them. And meanwhile, we had a whole series of other problems to focus on. First and foremost, for the last decade and a half, counterterrorism and the wars that the counterterrorist mission spawned in the greater Middle East, not to mention the rise of China, another large, powerful country with potentially revisionist ambitions at the global level. And given all of that, Russia seemed like yesterday's news and yesterday's problem. And so I think there was an underinvestment in resources, military, financial, and human, to really think critically about how Russia could develop and how it could potentially come to pose a threat to U.S. interests.
Turning back to you, Will Pomerantz, to what extent do you think the Obama administration, either through its actions or inactions, may have helped to spawn or encourage Vladimir Putin's adventurism? Some opinion editorialists and analysts think that when President Obama issued the red line and did not enforce it in Syria, that that was a sort of green light to Vladimir Putin that he could go in to Crimea, take it, and there would be no consequences. And then, of course, we see the dealings in Russia between Foreign Minister Lavrov and then U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, that Russia obviously has the upper hand, even though they violated so many agreements in the past. Does this type of diplomacy on the part of the United States encourage Russia to continue?
Well, I think the various events that you might think have triggered Putin's belief that he could get away with what he's doing. I think in many ways, the event that's more important than the Syria red line, although that is yet another example of Obama not backing up what he said he was going to do. In many ways, I think one could point to Georgia in 2008, where in a very disorganized attempt by the Georgians to reassert sovereignty over a part of their region, Putin responded, and instead of getting punished, he got the reset. So I think that if he perceived a weakness at that point, I think it was the fact that he was able to assert himself in the post-Soviet space, a million regions that Russia already de facto controlled. But he was able to do that, and instead of polarizing reaction, obviously some people spoke out against it. There's the famous John McCain line that we were all Georgians, but that didn't last very long. And as a result, when he came back, there was the reset and attempt to improve U.S.-Russian relations. So I think that Putin for a long time has believed that the strength of the West and the United States was in fact overestimated and that they would not be willing to confront him. And he particularly, I think, realized that they would not confront him in Russia's own backyard. And so when he decided after the collapse of the Yanukovych regime to do something, his calculations are actually correct. There was no reaction when little green men appeared and Russia took over Crimea. The West basically said to Ukraine, don't do anything. And it was only after Russia decided to engage in eastern Ukraine, and only in many ways after the shooting down of the airplane over Ukraine, that the West actually introduced sanctions that had some bite. So I think at various stages, Putin has probed and figured out what he could get away with.
Jeffrey Mankoff, do you think to some extent the West has aided and abetted Vladimir Putin's adventurism?
Again, I think that this adventurism comes out of things that have happened primarily inside Russia. That said, U.S. action and inaction has at times signaled that there's a relatively permissive environment for conducting that kind of adventurism. And certainly the conflict in Georgia in 2008 is a good example of that. Now, the Russian military had preparations for operations throughout the post-Soviet space going back to the 1990s, and there were people warning when Ukraine first became an independent state at the end of the Cold War to watch Crimea because it was a place where there could be some effort on the part of the Russian military to change the status quo by force. And the fact that that didn't happen for 25 years, I think, lulled people into thinking that it was not going to happen or that it could never happen. I will say that one of the things that the Obama administration has done that I think has made the situation worse has been the repeated signaling of an unwillingness to use force. Yes, it was always unlikely under any American administration that the U.S. military was going to get involved in a conflict in the post-Soviet region that would involve confronting Moscow. And again, in 2008, when the Bush administration was in power, there was very little desire on the part of American officials to risk a confrontation with Russia. However, what's happened under the Obama administration, I think, has been there's a very overt signaling that force was off the table, whether that was providing lethal military assistance to Ukraine, whether it was the failure to enforce the red line comment on Syria, and making so clear that force or military operations of any kind are not an option has been a very clear signal to Putin and to other potentially revisionist actors that there's a lot that they can get away with before the United States will do anything. And then in a lot of ways, the U.S. and its allies got into trouble on both Georgia and Ukraine because of the decision that was taken at the Bucharest NATO summit in 2008, which in a lot of ways was the worst of both worlds because it promised that NATO would admit both Georgia and Ukraine, but it didn't provide them the security guarantees that go with membership, and it didn't lay out a time frame or a membership action plan for them actually getting there. So it was seen as provocative in Moscow, but without the concomitant security guarantees that would actually make the prospect of membership something to take seriously. And in Georgia in 2008 and in Ukraine in 2014, Russia was willing to show what the gap was between the rhetoric and the actual intentions, and I think we're still paying for that.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Jeffrey Mankoff, from whom you just heard. He's Deputy Director and Senior Fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasia Program. And Will Pomerantz, he's Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. both think tanks are based here in Washington, were discussing the implications of the deteriorating state of U.S.-Russian relations. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener from Boku, Ghana, Sule Nafio Zangbio. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you. And now sort of a lightning round, Will Pomerantz. We are where we are. Russia's in the driver's seat, one could say, in many ways, whether it's in eastern Ukraine, in Syria. Now the hacking of the DNC really coming into, you know, the U.S. political system, this is really hitting home. How serious is this, and how serious are the implications?
It is a very serious development. It is still interesting, at least at the time of this program, the U.S. government hasn't really directly named Russia as the source of the hacking. It's unclear whether they will do so or what measures they would take as a result of it. But it's quite clear that Russia has used its traditional means of deniability somehow in a country where there's heavily regulated internet and media, that somehow there are these lone hackers potentially that are outside of its control. So they still have this aim of deniability, but of course, from the U.S. standpoint, Russia's credibility is virtually nil. These are the same people who insisted the Little Green Men were not Russians, that they were not in eastern Ukraine, that there was no central doping of Russian athletes and so forth. So I think we have to see what the official U.S. government response will be, whether the United States decides to name Russia directly as the source of this hacking. And what has to be making the U.S. rethink its decision or weigh its decision is, do they want to pursue at least attempts at cooperation in Syria? Or what would be the consequences if they named Russia as the source of this hacking, and therefore watch any attempts to address the issues that they think that the U.S. and Russia can address jointly essentially go down the drain?
Well, Jeffrey Mankoff, one could question, you know, how can there be cooperation in Syria when Moscow and Washington are on completely opposite sides of the conflict? It seems implausible.
Well, I don't think Washington and Moscow are completely on opposite sides of the conflict in Syria. I think there's some pretty serious disagreements, and there's the huge gap in trust that you mentioned at the beginning. But I think there are key objectives that both sides would subscribe to. Now, whether those are sufficient to actually have some kind of cooperation is another story. And that's not even taking into consideration the other issues in the relationship that we talked about. Obviously, it's difficult to separate the overall state of the U.S.-Russia relationship and the problems related to the interference in the U.S. elections and to what Russia is doing in Ukraine and in Europe, which we haven't really even talked about, on the one hand, and then trying to cooperate despite all of that in Syria. It would be a neat trick if you could pull it off, and I think the administration is trying very hard to do that without a whole lot of success. That doesn't mean that it's not worth the effort. I think the scale of the suffering in Syria and the scale of the threat that the Syrian conflict poses to stability, not only in Syria itself, but in the broader Middle East and even in Europe because of the refugee crisis, is such that it justifies pretty serious steps towards finding some kind of a political resolution. Because Russia is one of the key players in the conflict, I think any political resolution ultimately has to have a Russian role in it.
Right, but very briefly, they're not talking about a political resolution. They're talking about just a cessation of hostilities, which is already breaking down. Mm-hmm. And we know for a fact that Russia does not have the kind of influence over Assad that Iran does. So there are major problems in Syria. But beyond that, quickly, with respect to punishment or some kind of consequences for Russia vis-a-vis what they are doing in the United States to disrupt the election or...
Yeah, I mean, on Syria, right now, yes, we're talking about a limited ceasefire, but there's a bigger end game here. I'm skeptical that we're going to be able to get to it before the end of this administration, but that is what ultimately they're pushing for. In terms of the hacking and everything else, it is very serious. There is not really any precedent, even going back into the Cold War, for this level of Russian attempts to sway the conduct of American domestic politics. And because there's not really a precedent for it, I think we're struggling to figure out how to respond. This is not a military operation. I don't think we have spent enough time thinking doctrinally about cyber and other kinds of influence operations. And we've been a little bit flat-footed, not only on the question of attribution, but also in thinking about how to respond. But here again, the reluctance on the part of this administration to go down the path of escalation, even in a non-military sphere, I think hampers the ability to carry out a response that might establish some kind of deterrence vis-a-vis Russia in the future.
In the very few minutes we have left, I want to ask you two quick questions. And one, we know that there are elections for the Duma coming up in Russia. Very briefly, Will Pomerantz, what's at stake in these elections?
Well, at stake theoretically is who controls the legislature, but in light of the campaign that's gone on so far, it's unlikely that the election will be decisive in terms of serving as a challenge to Putin's authority.
And Jeffrey Mankoff, what's at stake in your view? And is there anything left of the opposition, or have they all been intimidated and cowed into silence for fear of getting, you know, murdered on the streets like so many before them?
There is still an opposition. There's not really much organized political opposition that has a chance of taking seats from the United Russia Party. It's less of an election and more of a plebiscite on United Russia. Now, that said, I don't think it's an entirely meaningless election. If the Levada Center poll is correct and only about half of the country supports United Russia, that could potentially augur some uncertainty about what the future holds. The other piece of this, of course, is that the Duma election is in some ways a trial run for the Russian presidential election, which is coming up next year. And if the results of the Duma election show that there is a fairly substantial undercurrent of dissatisfaction, then that means that the Kremlin has X amount of time to perfect the different levers of influence, to perfect its message, to make sure that there's not a rerun of that kind of uncertainty when the election that really matters, which is the one about Putin's continuation in the Kremlin, comes about next year. Elections in the post-Soviet world are often very highly stage-managed, but that doesn't mean that they're meaningless. The Bolotnaya protests in Russia in 2011-2012, which I think actually played a role in this shift towards a more confrontational foreign policy that we've been talking about. So elections don't function the way that they do in the West, but I also don't think that they're meaningless.
Well, speaking of those very protests, Vladimir Putin has blamed Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State at the time, for inciting them. Well, speaking of Hillary Clinton, as we close, we know how a President Donald Trump would be dealing with Vladimir Putin, don't we, Will Pomerantz? So they'd be wheeling and dealing, and they would be getting along just great. So assuming that, what if Clinton becomes president? How do you think she will handle or deal with Vladimir Putin's Russia differently than the Obama administration?
I would anticipate a lot of continuity between the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. I don't see necessarily that she would, for example, increase the level of sanctions. I think that she might try to draw a line in the sand. But I haven't heard anything from Clinton's staff that suggests that she has a radically different plan to deal with Syria or to deal with Ukraine.
Well, Jeffrey Mankoff, again, assuming we know how Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin would get along and deal with one another, how would Secretary Clinton, if she became president, in your view, change policy vis-a-vis Russia, or do you think there will be continuity?
First of all, let me say that I'm not sure that we know what a Trump-Putin relationship would look like. Trump tries to give the image of an admirer of Putin, somebody who can cut deals with him. But this is somebody who I think is unpredictable, who has no core political philosophy other than his own self-interest, and who has no experience in government. Once he's actually in that chair of the commander-in-chief, I think we really don't know what's going to happen. As far as a Clinton administration, I do think there'd be a lot of continuity with the Obama administration's approach to Russia, with some tinkering around the edges. While I don't think that a Clinton administration would have a fundamentally new approach to the conflict in Syria or in Ukraine, I think the instincts are different. Clinton is somebody who has a lot of experience in foreign policy, who I think thinks about it. And based on the way that Secretary Clinton has talked about Putin, has talked about Russia, the instincts seem to be more willing to accept confrontation as the price for getting the things that she wants to get in terms of the relationship. So I imagine that relations with Moscow would continue to be tense, but that there would also be a greater willingness on the part of the U.S. to push back.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Will Pomeranz. He's deputy director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, and Jeffrey Mankoff. He's deputy director and senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Russia and Eurasia program. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your terrific insights.
Sure, thanks for having us.
My pleasure.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.